Welcome to another episode of Badass Banking, and today I'm with Bob Morris. Bob is in Atlanta, or the suburbs thereof. Bob, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, sir.
You and I were talking politics, which is a very dangerous subject. Fortunately, we are fairly well aligned, and we also were talking about our history in the Chicago suburbs, which, you know what, I do miss it, and the fact that you brought up the movie Lucas is pretty funny, because I've been trying to get that to watch, and the only way you can do it is to buy the DVD. Yeah. Well, guess what? I don't have a DVD player.
Oh, that's too funny.
Does anyone have, do you have one still?
I still have one, and I have it, and I do have the movie.
Do you have the movie?
I do, yeah. You know what? After this, I probably should just send it up to you. And then you got to go buy one.
But Charlie Sheen was in. That was filmed in mostly in like Wheaton, Illinois, which is where Bob is from. I was from Glenellen, Illinois. It was filmed predominantly at my high school, Glenbard West High School. And that was Charlie Sheen's first movie, if I remember.
Yeah.
Right? And who else was in that? Wasn't Corey Haim in that or somebody?
Yeah, Corey Haim is in there. Yeah.
Corey Haim. And who's the brunette? Her first movie, too.
Yeah. They all turned out.
Looks like my wife.
They had big careers.
Yeah. I'll, what was her name?
I don't remember her name. I said they all had big careers, though, after that movie.
I can't remember. Anyway, so Bob, tell me a little about you. I know that you're the founding partner of a company called Bravery, and you told me a little about where that name came from. First of all, tell me a little about what the company does.
Yeah, so basically it was set up, so a little backstory, it was set up actually as a holding company from an investment perspective as we started to look at kind of the next generation of opportunity. And in particular, one of the categories was within banking. And so really what it is it's a holding company from an investment perspective. It's comprised actually of a number of individuals that came out of, banking, and also came out of kind of the global agency space, if you will. And I was founded about a year ago. It came out of the conclusion of a buyout of a prior company that I had co-founded. That company was actually, a management advisory for, Fortune 100 for CMOs. Who's really focused.
Was that Trade?
That was Trade. Yeah. And Trade was actually, so there's an interesting backstory on it real quick. So Trade was founded in 2012 after my run at Ogilvy, where I was, my title was SVP on the digital side. And a bunch of us that had worked together over the years came together and founded that company. So it was actually originally founded by, one of the individuals who had been at Coke for a long time, and he was actually the head of the Coke brand.
And I guess that's how you ended up in Atlanta.
Well, it's one of the ways. So this guy, Steve Hutcherson, well-known, super smart. And then another founder was a guy named Rick Shaughnessy, and Rick Shaughnessy is the former global chief creative officer of a company called IXL or Scient. Mm-hmm. That's actually the predecessor to Razorfish. So it's one of the companies that was rolled up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm familiar with him actually.
Yeah. So Rick Shaughnessy was one of the partners, and another one, Jeff Mikes. And Jeff had been a CFO and had been at Publicis, one of the big ad agency holding companies, where he had done one of the early roll-ups of digital assets. So we created that company. It was actually called Trade NTE, so Narrative Technology and Economics. It had three different practices, and it was really focused on the issue of customer acquisition and digital transformation.
That remains a big challenge for our banker friends and our fintech friends.
Absolutely. So ironically, in a prior life, one of my lead clients had been the head of acquisition at GMAC on the insurance side. So most people didn't realize GMAC was the fifth largest auto insurer back in the day. Little piece of irony, if you did we were talking about research earlier, if you did a research study on GMAC and polled people who had GMAC auto insurance, you would have a huge number that would say that they had. The reality was they'd never had insurance, but they'd had a car loan, right? And so they got confused and kind of in that picture, but in the big picture, they were actually the fifth largest. So that client became one of the early clients of Trade. And when I say that client, he had gone on and had a career at Discover Financial, And then the team that was at Discover Financial that was led by a woman named Chris Favilla, Chris and Kevin, and then a woman named Katie Starr, who he had hired, all these people left joined up to create the leadership team, were recruited to create the leadership team of GE Capital Bank.
Okay.
So GE Capital Bank became the first major client of my company, based on our history, prior history of working with these folks. And so when GE Capital Bank was essentially started as a startup, we were the company that got brought in to essentially help from the ground up, basically do the technology selections, develop the brand and the brand architecture, the social strategy, the content strategies, all the various components of the business. And so that was really kind of the fundamental that got our business running and really got us into the financial sector to the degree that we ended up.
And GE Capital's gone as we know it, right?
So GE Capital has primarily divested their assets. If you look at GE Capital Bank, so at one point you had Synchrony and GE Capital Bank, yep. right? Which were really competing banks, right? Yep. There's a fascinating kind of backstory to it, which is, you know, the funding of GE Capital Bank came through, or the customer base came through an acquisition of MetLife's banking asset.
Yep.
And it was originally supposed to go to GE Capital Bank. And literally at the last moment, those funds were rolled into Synchrony. And so here you sit with a bank and no customers to start with. You've got your charter. And so off we went, you know, with a mandate to basically build out, you know, a solution for GE Capital. If you know anything about the GE Capital scenario without getting into too much, you know that, you know, when the credit market seized up, the feds were pretty unhappy with GE Capital's situation. And they weren't able to really address that without having to get into the market and basically bring retail deposits. And so that was really the strategy.
Yeah, I know they were huge into leasing, equipment leasing, and a friend of mine ran their wholesale lending group. So he was doing wholesale warehouse mortgages, actually.
GE Capital was an interesting business, right? So I did a tremendous amount of work earlier in my career at GE Capital Auto Finance, so GAFS. And, you know, AFS was just a monster. So one of the largest, you know, auto leasing businesses, right? They carried all the paper. And so, you know, that was a huge part of the business as well. Most of that has been divested, right, over time, just because of the refocus, if you will, from a business perspective. But then, you know, GE Capital Bank became Goldman Sachs Marcus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I get is I get a lot of inquiries and a lot of conversations around that because Marcus is viewed as being kind of the next generation Goldman Sachs really reimagining and reinventing. And so I get people reaching out to me often asking, you know, well, you know, you worked on GE Capital Bank. What does that really mean? What is the real underpinning of Marcus?
No one seems to have a great answer for that right now, other than they're doing great. Marcus is doing great. And I guess it was Friday, Goldman announced the acquisition of somebody's credit card portfolio.
Yeah. I mean, they're super smart. I mean, it was a good acquisition for them because they really got it at a very small valuation, right, in comparison. That was a pretty big portfolio at the time that they actually picked it up. So, you know, it's one of those ones where it's like, it wasn't considered a big bank, right? By total deposits. So clearly you're not in the top threshold, but because of the types of deposits that were in that bank, it made it really, really unique. So I'll share a couple insights if you don't mind.
Please do.
So here's what's interesting. So we worked under McKinsey's strategy. Mm-hmm. So McKinsey had been brought in by GE Capital to basically figure out what would it take to stand up a bank under the Fed's regulations, right? And their requirements. And what did they need to do to basically leverage what they'd already kind of built out as a business, right? So I won't remember these numbers exactly because it's been a number of years, but it was something like, I think they thought that, so there were two products, right? There was a high yield savings and high yield CD. So those were the two products. That's it. Nothing else. No checking account. Like this is it. It's a pretty stripped down bank. But part of the reason for that was we needed to be able to stand up the bank very quickly. We only had 7 months to stand up the bank. And you know what it's like, That's usually multiple years to kind of work your way through. So it was a startup within GE. I mean, literally we were like hunting real estate in buildings they had and trying to figure out like, where can I put people? So it's a great backstory. It's one that someday needs to kind of be an HBR piece. But the reality was, you only had two products and you're online. You're just digital. Right. That's it. So McKinsey had done this analysis, and I believe that the number was something like, it was like $4,700 or something like that was what they had anticipated would be the initial funding of an account. That would be your initial $4,700 would be your initial deposit. Yep. Right. The reality was we ended up being, I believe if I recall correctly, we ended up being closer to like 49,000.
Wow. Okay. Just off a little bit.
Oh, it was insane. And so, but that says something, right? Like what's going on? How can those numbers be off that far? And McKinsey had done a great job. What we found out was people were using, because it was such a high yield, we were basically buying market, mm-hmm. right? Go to bank rate, here we are. So most of the funds or a large portion of the funds that were coming through were actually coming through as a holding between accounts, mm-hmm. right? So it's moving from an investment fund, it's a wealth manager who's overseeing X, they're dropping those funds in for a short period of time and then those funds are moving again, right? So really what it was wealthy individuals who were essentially parking money at the highest rate they could get at that time as they shifted between accounts. So that makes it a really interesting audience though. Right. Because now you start thinking about what can you sell to them. So now you think, now you look at it and go, well, why did Goldman Sachs buy it?
Yeah.
Here you go. Here's the backstory.
There's a wealth management strategy buried in there somewhere. Market acquisition, right? Relationship
you got
management.
It.
I mean, yeah, huge opportunity. Hmm. Now, you've worked, aside from GE Capital, you know, you've got experience with New York Life, BlackRock, MasterCard, B of A, Intuit, Merrill, SunTrust, Genworth, Wachovia, BB&T.
Yep.
What have you been doing for them? Has it always been focused on the challenge of digital transformation?
It is. Yeah. I mean, if you go back way back in my career, so I was in the 90s, I was CEO actually of a company that was at the time the fifth largest digital agency in the world. And you know, even back then, we built a product for a bank that no one will remember. It was a bank called Premier.
Oh, I vaguely remember the name. Although, knowing the banking industry, there's probably like 30 Premier banks.
Exactly. So we built a product for Premier Bank, and it was called Money, How to Help Your Banker Say Yes. And that was basically my first real foray into the category. And it was really around small business and trying to help small businesses to actually understand what it is that they need to do in terms of all the paperwork they need to have, everything they need to do, and a prequal, like walk you through your financials, give you a prequal, and then see whether or not you actually should be standing behind the banker or sitting with a banker and having that conversation. And that was in the 90s that we produced that. Well, we actually retained the license to it after we built it for Premier, and then Norwest Bank bought it. If you remember those guys.
I do.
So Norwest bought it, and then United Carolina Bank bought it, then BB&T bought it, and each time it was customized specifically to their you know, their needs.
You just mentioned a few brands that don't even exist anymore, really. At least from a consumer-facing point of view.
None of them do. I mean, BB&T is now Truist.
Truist.
So that was really kind of the intro. And then what ended up happening was we got really focused more on solving complex challenges. So like for BlackRock, we got brought in very early on the ETF side to build a solution to really convey what ETFs are. So we did an entire education platform for financial advisors to teach them basically what an ETF was. And it's always been more complex financial solutions that we've been working on. But the last probably 10, 15 years or so, it's really been way more focused on bottom of funnel. Mm-hmm. So it's really about SEO. It's about how do you get cost out. It is some paid search, but really we deal primarily on on customer acquisition, but with a real focus on delivering the best possible experience we can within the platform itself, right? Mm-hmm. So I stay away, I try to primarily stay away from the ad tech side of the business. I just have some issues there. I mean, clearly I've worked at Ogilvy and I've worked at a number of the big agencies, the holding companies, but I'm more concerned about, are we getting the right individual and are we managing them through the process efficiently? And are we giving them everything that they need in order to be able to have an exceptional customer service? And so then all the way through to the onboarding, that's really where I've spent the majority of my time over the last probably 10 years or so.
So it sounds like you're less interested in acquisition and more interested in once they're into that funnel, managing through the process and retaining them as a relationship.
That's true. Yeah. And it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, it depends on where we're at, right? I mean, so GE Capital Bank's a great example. We kept getting turned off, right? Meaning that we had to stop all of our efforts because, you know, when you get out of sync in terms of your lending to your portfolio of your deposits, right? And it kept happening to us because clearly we were in demand, right? Because we're sitting on, you know, rates that were really, really strong rates in the market at that time. And, you know, so you have to be able to make sure that, you know, your business is oriented in a way that says, you know, look, when that stuff's happening, we still have consultants, we still have teams of people that need to be working. And so you got to have the right balance. And so, yeah, that's really kind of where it's at. I mean, GE Capital Bank, when you look at it, when we first started with Kevin and the team there, we analyzed what was needed, right, to deliver that bank. Or 14 different technology stacks just on our side. So that's not even talking about things like FIS and core banking systems, right? Yeah. We had 14, and of the 14, we had to do evaluations across 72 different vendors.
I don't even want to think about that.
Well, yeah. And, you know, in banking, I mean, the problem today is, and I mean, I'm literally sitting here. I mean, I have a copy of a bunch of them sitting here on my desk as we're talking. I mean, you look at the financial technology landscape and, you know, I feel for organizations that don't have the capability or don't have the dollars, right? So when you talk about those banks that get below $20 billion in deposit, I mean, this is a complex mess.
Yeah, it is. And it's tough to make a living too when you're in that asset class, right? With margin compression. I mean, These are tough days. Have you seen the bank earnings lately? I mean,
they're terrible, right? And I live in an area. I mean, and I don't know if I sent this to you or not, but I mean, I live in an area that, you know, I live in a beautiful area in north and west of Atlanta, up kind of in the mountains. And you know, average household income's high. You know, I mean, there's, you can kind of go down the list of all the various things. We only had two bank branches, both of which are permanently shuttered.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, literally they're permanently shuttered. They've announced those bank branches will never reopen. At least under those banks, Wells Fargo being one of them. And you kind of look at it and you go, yeah. I mean, especially when you think about, like, if you were a smaller bank and under the restrictions that we've had and an inability to be able to be open, right. So many of those smaller banks, as you well know, right. And credit unions, they relied heavily on an older audience.
Yep.
That wanted the in-person, in-bank, in-branch experience. They're not digitally native. They're not comfortable necessarily with many of the tools. And so those banks are trying to pivot. And as they're trying to pivot, you know, the problem is that, you know, A, they don't have the dollars to do a lot of what needs to be done. B, they don't necessarily have all the experience either.
Right.
And now you get consultants from all over the place that are all trying to sell them a software platform. Versus not necessarily trying to sell them a solution.
Right.
And that was kind of where, you know,
that's a common problem.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I mean, the problem, it compounds itself because, you know, you got enough VC and enough PE kind of playing in the market today that we're just building software tools everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, Scott Brinker's chief MarTech, right? That stack, you know, what, last year, 7,400 companies in it. I think this year the expectation was it would be over 9,500 MarTech companies that are in it.
Yep.
At what point have we just made it so difficult to even figure out? And the differences between some of these technologies are so minute now that you just kind of scratch your head and you go, why in the world are we continuing to build, you know, we have, you know, 400 chatbots.
Yeah. And I think that's why the consulting industry has been booming, you know, because the bankers and the fintechs need, you know, third parties to help them figure it out. They need architects. They need guidance to help them navigate these waters now because they are so complex. There's so many different choices. You know, it's a challenging time. By the way, it's Winona Ryder.
Oh, there you go.
Winona Ryder, just dawned on me. Winona Ryder got her career started in Lucas, which was filmed in the towns that, you know, Bob and I used to live in. So important that we share that.
That's fantastic. Now it's going to stick with me.
All the memories are flowing.
That's awesome.
So you posted an article in Medium a couple of days ago about the due diligence that's involved in, I guess it was an agency acquisition.
Yeah.
That had to be a nightmare. I've been involved in due diligence on the banking side. Mm-hmm. I got involved in M&A activity at Summit Bank back in the, in a little at Core States back in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And it was actually fun. We had the RTC involved. It was during the S&L crisis. So it was kind of a rush to be able to do some of the things we did. A lot of these were failed thrifts that we were able to, in essence, you know, gather market share very quickly by, you know, consuming them. So tell me about this $300 million agency acquisition and what you had to do on the due diligence side. What made it a nightmare?
What made it a nightmare? You know, so it's an interesting story, right? I mean, so we, because my company was, so back up just 1 second. So we were the consultants, right? We were the management consultants solving the problem. But we always partnered with technology companies to do the implementation. Part of the reason for that was because, you know, we had teams that were in Colorado and, you know, Illinois and New York and Atlanta. But one of the things we didn't want to do is we didn't want to be a hammer looking for a nail. And you know what it's like. I mean, you've been in the space. And so you know that it's like, look, you know, if I have 25 people to do content, I need to sell you content services. The strategy needs to end with a content strategy.
Yeah.
And that just wasn't who we were. We had hired in a lot of super, super smart strats that you know, were industry vets. And so because we were constantly getting to a place where once the strategy's done, there's an execution, we would go and partner. We would help either the client do the direct contracting or we would contract the third party. Typically, we worked with the client to do it because from an E&O perspective, our goal was to try to keep it off our insurance, right, from a liability perspective. Mm-hmm. So we had brought in a company called ICF to do some work for us for, at that time, for Bank of America. Mm-hmm. So we were working on work. We were actually working on the merchant services side for Bank of America. And we laid out a strategy for them. They were actually a joint venture with First Data.
Okay.
And so, you know, we had technologies like Salesforce and you name it. And so we had narrowed down to a place where we were looking at Adobe and Sitin and Lattice Engines for lead scoring. And we brought them in and we were doing all this work with them. And it turns out that they were in market competing against Accenture at the time and others, right, looking to try to add on to their consulting side of the business. So ICF was a federal contractor that had some commercial market work, but not a tremendous amount. And they really felt like they needed to be able to compete on that side because guess what? Accenture, Booz, McKinsey, Deloitte, everybody was buying these agencies and rolling them up. And so they had this creative capability, right, to solve for these really innovative digital experiences and other types. So because we had been doing this work with ICF, they started to get to understand who we were. And as they went into market to look for an acquisition, they lost on a major acquisition that they were pursuing. And it made them highly aggressive in the market. And they were looking for somebody who actually knew the space and knew the industry. And we had done, as a company, we had done agency retooling work because we'd come out of the space. Mm-hmm. And also Jeff Mikes, who was one of the business partners who ran the economic practice for us, was actually the business advisor, management advisor for SODA. So SODA is the Society of Digital Agencies. Really exclusive group, difficult to get into, been around for a number of years, but it's where, you know, companies like Big Spaceship, Domani, these companies that have been acquired by the big holding companies, it's kind of where they come from. Mm-hmm. And because we knew the space, and every year there's a big financial roll-up that's done as a study for them, It's internal. And we oversaw that study. They knew we understood rates, we understood margin, we understood salaries, we understood everything about the sector. They wanted us to come in and basically do a top to bottom forensics on Olson, which was the last of the big kind of independents that was left.
Oh, that was the deal, was Olson?
It was Olson.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
You know, and those guys...
There's a name from the past.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Olson was an interesting company because the KRG, so I'll give a little more backstory. KRG was the private equity firm that had rolled up Olson. And so they had made a number of different acquisitions, a company called MyThumb out of Canada. They had rolled up CityTech from an engineering perspective. They rolled up Olson itself, right, as a collective. And then they pulled together a company called Denali, which is Tally. Mm-hmm. And Tally is basically the big CRM platform that competes against Epsilon and others. Real strong in the travel and hospitality sector.
A lot of parallels between banking and fintech and agency and the digital agency activity. You've got a ton of acquisition, yet you have a ton of entrepreneurship that's kind of feeding the industry as well, that's driving that inertia forward. So you expect there's going to be more deals in the future and this momentum is going to continue, or do you think COVID's going to slow it down a bit?
COVID's slowing it down. It's definitely slowing it down. The holding companies are really struggling. You know, financially, you've seen their numbers, performance is pretty poor.
Just like the banks,
a lot of layoffs. You know, unfortunately, you know, we can get into a totally different conversation about what you're seeing in terms of the types of layoffs. You know, a lot of really, really senior people that are very talented that ran big practices are now out in market because, you know, there is a bit of ageism in that category. And, you know, there's quite a few articles that have come out even in the last, you know, 2 to 3 weeks about ageism in the advertising sector and where these cuts are coming from.
Oh, but, I've seen it, having spent a little agency time. I saw it just in the Richmond area here.
Yeah, it's rough, right? And so, you know, so that was going on. So we went in, and what was interesting about the Olson acquisition was, so you had companies like Jefferies, you had PwC, you had Ad Media Partners, you had all these different players, and you had both sides of the table. And we were really the company that was asked to kind of do the top to bottom because, you know, these guys knew financial, mm-hmm. they, you know, everybody knows their place, but do you really understand an agency from top to bottom? And one of the things they actually even asked us to do was a forensic accounting analysis to do a top to bottom because the numbers didn't seem to really make a whole lot of sense. And the reason why the numbers didn't make a whole lot of sense is because, you know, KRG had rolled this thing up, but had never integrated it.
Right.
So they never spent any money. So you can drive a lot of margin out of really, really good acquisitions. But if you've got five different accounting systems and you've got five different financial teams and you've got all these various things, you only run that so long before that's going to start to come apart on itself, right? And in the
that's world, another thing you see in the banking industry. You know, I've known many banks that have joined forces, but they're running parallel cores, for example, and it's two different experiences that are being run. So it has an impact on the end user, i.e., the customer or the client.
It's a huge impact, and in the case of advertising, it's a huge impact from the perspective that, you know, you think about it. If you have a project manager and he's pulling skills across four different business units, he's having to do reconciliation against four different systems with four different finance people.
Yeah.
And people are having to put time in and code management. And by the time you get to efficiency, it's blown, right? I mean, it's just, it's not there. So we did that due diligence. At the end of the day, we were the only company that presented to the board. It's a beautiful doc. I still love it. I still reference it. A lot of work went into it to understand the customer, and their perspectives. We did an analysis to look at the quality of the service offerings and the trend against the service offering to see whether or not it was still a scalable component of the business or whether you were going to see shrinkage on a forward-looking basis. You know, it was again, just a lot of due diligence. Now, the hard part, and I say it in the article, the hard part about it was sometimes these companies get so aggressive on the acquisition side, they don't want to see the bad parts.
Right.
And there was a point in time where we actually were even essentially told, just don't even look any further, because it was starting to get pretty ugly. Because once we found some problems, no one wanted those problems to be dug into much further. And, you know, and I'm saying this and I'm recorded, and it's funny because it's a publicly traded company. So now somebody's going to go back and look at it and be like,
I can edit this out if you want.
You can edit that part out. But no, you know, I mean, so learning the due diligence process though was really fascinating for me, because now you're into all the facets of an organization and what it looks like. And I think, you know, to your point, bringing it back to the banking side, you know, the challenge in the banking sector is that, and you know this exceptionally well, is that the smaller banks are being absorbed, but they're not being absorbed in value. They're being absorbed because they can no longer really compete from a performance perspective, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're selling it in a position of weakness often, which is not exactly what a shareholder's looking for either.
No, the shareholders aren't looking for that, but the shareholders of the companies that are acquiring absolutely love it.
Absolutely, bargain buys, yep.
Yeah, they're bargain buys. And I think, you know, COVID, what it's done is it's accelerated that process, because if you're a small regional bank and you're not even able to run your branches because you've been locked down and you didn't have a very strong digital presence, the problem that you have is that your customers are leaving, and they're not necessarily leaving specifically to go to another bank. What we're starting to see, and I think you've seen it in some of the stuff I've seen you talk about, is the fact that they're moving to non-traditional financial companies, right? So they're working, you know, you look at the fintech list of the landscape and you're like, so many non-traditionals is where people are now putting their money, or they're using it as their mechanism of their bank. Yeah. So Zelle all of a sudden becomes the equivalent of my bank, right? Or Venmo becomes kind of how I think about my finances.
Right. It's having an impact on how people think about banking. There's no doubt about it. My children, your children, they think about banking totally different than how you and I do or did.
You know? Yeah. And the question that I would even throw back to you is, I mean, when you look at non-traditional, right, and you look at what's happening in the behaviors, the question I have for everyone is, why do banks today still look at customers the way that they always have, right? It's a fundamental shift that needed to have occurred, and it's still not occurring. I mean, Bank of America still looks at me as, you know, 116-2747, right? Like I'm a number in a system and that's it.
Yeah.
Right. And my only relationship that I have to Bank of America is essentially an email that I get, or an alert on my app that I might get. There isn't a relationship that I have, yet people will tell you that they feel like they have a relationship with Venmo.
Yeah.
Which is different.
That's very interesting and probably spot on.
And why, right? Like the question is why the banks have had you as a customer. Why have the banks not made a conscious decision to move forward from a technology perspective? And I know we could get into the whole, you've got risk management and you've got compliance and you've got all these other functions that exist, and they're much looser in something like a Venmo, because Venmo doesn't have any of those same kind of requirements, right?
Exactly.
So the question really that I think we have to be asking is also one of the challenges in the market, the way that we regulate banks versus the way we regulate these non-traditional financial institutions, because they're sliding into the number one position of how you look at your finances, but they're not regulated in the same fashion. And so therefore we've put banks in a disadvantage.
Yeah. The bankers will agree with you there. Listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I think we're going to have to pick this up yet again, you know, really interesting. I'm just glad I figured out the Winona Ryder
thing. I love it. Now that's going to stick with me.
Yeah. I need to find the DVD. I'll put in the comments on Spotify and on Google Podcasts, on YouTube, all your contact info. Very interesting to see some of the parallels between what's going on in the agency space as well as what's going on in fintech. And you know what? It's probably happening to other industries as well. And there's probably something for the bankers and the fintechs to learn from by looking at other industries rather than having their blinders on and only look at, you know, what they're really intimately comfortable with.
Right. Right.
Interesting. Well, it's been a pleasure. I do appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Much appreciated.
All right. And I'll end it right about there. That was good.
It's, I mean, you know, I don't know if that's hitting on your core.